You're listening to OzCat Radio, 89.5 FM KZCT in Vallejo, California. I'm Jeremy, and we're speaking with John Steele, author and former conflict cameraman, about his time in some of the hot spots of the world. So we heard how you got out of Iraq, but you ended up back. How did that happen?
When I left Iraq, put my camera on the ground and quit, went to the south of France. Hid out for a while, no radio, no newspaper, no TV, no nothing for a year, and coming back and being horrified at the number of suicides by American soldiers, I wrote a letter to the United States Army and said, I'd like to go be with a combat unit somewhere out in the middle of nowhere for 3 weeks, and I'd like to film them fly on the wall. And I'd like to talk to them about their emotions and feelings. And the military sort of said, excuse, you want to do what? You want to talk about their emotions and feelings? And I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. So because this was more of a documentary, it had to go through the film office in Los Angeles. And it took months to get approval. And the approval, I never thought I was going to get it. And I got a phone call from somebody who didn't quite identify themselves, but said, I'd just like you to level with me and tell me why you want to go do this, what you want to do, this idea. And I said, well, I grew up in a military family, so I have great respect for military personnel, especially military personnel in combat. And I would just like if the next time an American president comes knocking on America's door and says, give me your children that I may send them halfway around the world where they might die, that Americans and the press might ask more questions this time. And I thought, there was silence at the other end of the phone, and I thought to myself, well, that's that. I'll never get this. That's done. Mm-hmm. And the fellow said, thank you very much, Mr. Steele. I appreciate your candor and your honesty. And I said, thank you, sir. And a couple of weeks later, I got an email in my box. It was just like a movie. Ding, you know, ding, you have mail. And I opened it up, and I kid you not, it was an email from Major Smokin' Joe Sowers.
It sounds made up.
It sounds made up. But he had a name. He had this name because he was a boxer at at one point in his West Point career. And he was with the 115 Battalion. And he said, we're going to take you on. And that's how I went. I didn't expect to go, but I did go. I expected to be there 3 weeks. I stayed with these guys for 2.5 months on the ground in Iraq, and then another few weeks when they came back from Iraq at Fort Benning, Georgia, to get them when they returned home with their families. And when I got there, it was quite a unique experience because I was in very good shape. I had been, you know, really gotten myself in very good physical shape to do this. I was, you know, I was also 57 years old. Mm-hmm. And I walked in, and the captain, Captain Rich Thompson, who ran this company called Baker Boys. They're the only unit company that has that's allowed to use the nickname. Everybody else is Alpha, Bravo, Charlie. You know, they use the military parlance for the companies. But because of their history and everything else, they're allowed to use their name as Baker Company instead of Bravo Company. And he said to me, well, you know, you think you can keep up with us? And I said, yes, sir, I will. And he said, because we will leave you behind. And I said, understood. And I started going out, hanging out with these guys, and none of the soldiers trusted me because they had a very bad opinion of journalists, which I found out when I started asking people about would they like to do an interview. And one soldier said to me, no, I don't want to do an interview with you. And I said, well, why not? And he says, because you're not interested in an interview. And I said, well, what do you think I'm interested in? He says, you're interested in me in taking a bullet to the head while your camera's rolling. That's what you're interested in. So I realized I had a lot of work to do. And we started going out on missions. And some of those missions were, you know, chopper missions, flying in the middle of the night, dropping into a village, rounding up suspected Al-Qaeda people and bringing them back, or going through the villages in the day and going through doors. And we were also on a mission looking for, that I didn't realize at the time, looking for any evidence that there were some soldiers still alive who had been kidnapped, but it turned out they had been killed. And we were looking for evidence of where they might be, had they come through here, or indeed were they still alive. And I started going on the first choppers, and I would be the number three man going through a door and that sort of thing. And I started to earn their respect. So after 2 months of that, I set up in a little rundown building and put a camera on, and I would ask soldiers 20 questions. I didn't have to have them approved by the Army. By this time, even back at the Pentagon, they knew I was out there, and they knew the kind of stuff I was filming, and no one was stopping me. And I started to do this series of interviews with soldiers, asking them the same questions about their emotions and feelings. And I was doing it because I wanted my countrymen, who had was very happy to wave the flag and see all these, you know, kids go, the price that they were paying, not just physically, but emotionally and mm-hmm. mentally. I mean, there were some kids that would come in there and I'd say, one question was, where were you on September 11th when the Twin Towers came down? And some would say, well, I was in college, or I was working this job, or I was in basic training or something. And a couple of them would say, I was in the sixth grade. You know, mm-hmm. I was in the sixth grade. And you go, my God, you know. And you could see from the stories they were telling that some of these guys are going to be carrying scars a long time. Mm-hmm. I'm still friends with a lot of these guys. You know, we still talk on Facebook and we still send messages back and forth. But that's why I went. I didn't go for the glory. I didn't go to win awards. I didn't go to do a big news story. I just went out because I wanted Americans to see a different side of the war. You know, it wasn't all just bang, bang and boom, booms and let's wave the flag. It comes down to a very shocking statistic that we will end up as a country paying more for the care of soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder from this experience than the cost of the entire war itself.
Mm-hmm.
That is one statistic we're looking at, because this is running so deep and so horrible. And you can imagine how these kids feel. A lot of these guys went out there that they believed with their hearts and souls they were doing the right thing. They were answering, you know, somebody attacked us, we're going to attack them. We're going to get this guy. We're going to defeat Al-Qaeda. They believed it with their heart and soul. And then to find out it was all a lie.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough. And to see a lot of them lost a lot of friends.
I got my finger on the trigger, but I don't know who to trust. When I look into your eyes, there's just devils in dust. We're a long, long way from home, Bob. Home's a long, long way from us. Feel a dirty wind blowing. Devils in dust. I got God on my side, and I'm just trying to survive. What if what you do to survive kills the things you love? Fear's a powerful thing, can turn your heart black, you can trust. It'll take a God-filled soul, feel the devil's in dust. Well, I dreamed of you last night in a field of blood and stone. Well, the blood began to dry, the smell began to rise. Well, I dreamed of you last night, Bob, in a field of mud and bone. Well, your blood began to dry, they'll begin to rise. We've got God on our side, we're just trying to survive. What if what you do to survive kills the things you love? Fear's a powerful flame, it'll turn your heart black, you can trust. It'll take a God-filled soul, fill it with devil's and dust. It'll take a God-filled soul, fill it with devil's and dust.
I'm not a flag-waving American, but I was really proud being with these kids, and I was really, you know, proud of the way they did their job. And you know, I saw nothing but professionalism, you know, everywhere I went with this outfit.
Every woman and every man, they want to take a righteous stand, find the love of God will. Faith that he commands. I've got my finger on the trigger, and tonight faith just ain't enough. When I look inside my heart, there's just devils and dust. But I got God on my side, and I'm just trying to survive. What you do to survive kills the things you love. Fear's a dangerous thing, will turn your heart black, you can trust. It'll take your God-filled soul, fill it with devils and dust. It'll take your God-filled soul, fill it with devils and dust.
You're listening to OzCat Radio, 89.5 FM KZCT in Vallejo. I'm Jeremy, and this is All Over the Road. We're currently speaking with author and former war junkie John Steele about his award-winning TV documentary about the Iraq surge. I found it to be a really refreshing take on this documentary because when I started in on it, and I knew that this was a documentary about you being embedded back in the surge, it's the Baker Boys inside the surge, I figured that it would be an action movie. An action documentary. Yep. And in fact, all the action is emotional. All of the action is talking to the people, and it paints a portrait of the people who we send over there and ask to do all of this stuff in a way that action scenes really wouldn't have. We've all seen those. We see those in Hollywood movies.
Yeah, and you have a lot of journalists living for that right now. I mean, it's called war porn.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have to admit that, you know, I probably did some of that, you know, but you have to understand when I was doing it and starting it, no one was doing the kind of stuff I was doing in that way, trying to get in the middle of it, deliberately get in the middle of action and things. But I think that just reflects the time between writing War Junkie and when I went back to do the Baker Boys. I already had the reputation of, action man mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I already had that reputation. I didn't need it. I wanted to do something really genuine, and it wasn't supposed to be about me, but the producers and director in Los Angeles put me in it as a bit of a character, you know, talking about what it was like to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And then we dealt with some of the issues. You know, when that soldier said to me, all you're really interested in is me taking a bullet to the head while your camera is rolling. And if stuff happens, you know, my job would be to film it. Mm-hmm. And I had already had an agreement with the captain that if, you know, anything serious happened and everything else, I said, I will roll on everything. And he said, that's understood. You have clearance. You can roll on whatever you want. I mean, to the Army's credit, I had to have a contract with the Army. And the only thing with the Army was they wanted to review it, not to censor anything the soldiers said. Nothing along those lines. The only thing they wanted to do was to make sure nothing operational was leaked. Because obviously Americans weren't going to be the only people watching this film. Mm-hmm. The enemy watches every piece of news footage and documentary footage they can get their hands on. Mm-hmm. And there were only two things that the Army asked us to take out. One was something operational about a very clever trick that they played on bad guys to, you know, make them reveal themselves. And, you know, I had it on film and they said, you can't show that because mm-hmm. we still use it. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. And the other one was blacking out the face of one of the translators, Iraqi translators embedded with the Americans who wore an American uniform, because it turned out he was actually on the bad guys, one of the bad guys, and giving them information. So to protect, you know, whatever, you know, they said, we just don't show his face. So we black out his face. And that was the only thing. But, you know, soldiers sitting there and saying, this is just bullshit, blah, blah, blah. They didn't change anything. Mm-hmm. They didn't ask me to take out, you know, one line of one soldier being critical. They weren't all critical, but the ones that were critical, I was never asked to delete anything from them. So I give a lot of credit to the Army for letting that film go out. But I think the reason they let me make that thing is because I think by that time there were enough people in the senior ranks who were angry. Mm-hmm. Thousands of soldiers, thousands of kids, tens of thousands wounded, thousands killed. I mean, the numbers are, for a commander, mm-hmm. you know, no commander likes to lose a soldier. Mm-hmm. And I think there was enough anger in the higher command that when this thing floated up to the top, because it had to be approved by the Pentagon, that they said, let him do it. You know, if it's a disaster, we'll say, no, you can't show that. But in the end, they let me show the entire film. And, you know, I give them credit for that, because I think they wanted me to say and show something they couldn't talk about publicly. That, you know, this is what happens. This is the effect, you know, that this war has had on people. And if people ask the question about the next war, then, you know, that's all for the best. And that's actually kind of timely when you think about, you know, what's going on with this whole Iran thing. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there are people that just want forever war.
Mm, yep.
In the United States. Where is that, you know, where is that going to lead? Again, this goes back to history. You know, read history, read world history.
Oh, no, that's scary.
Read what happens to empires that just do nothing but war. You know, they don't last. They die.
I'm guessing that the acceptance of this project you were working on continued to grow as they actually started looking. How long did it take them to accept you, and was it watching what you were doing and listening to what you were asking and stuff like that that led to it? See that you're on their side.
They knew I wasn't on their side. They never accepted me as somebody on their side, and I was very honest about it. And I would say, like, look, you know, I'm totally against this war. I don't want you guys to be here. And I would tell them, I think you're here for the, you know, I don't believe you're here for the reasons you think you are. I respect that you believe you're here for the reasons you think you are. But, you know, I just have a different perception on it. Mm-hmm. It took a few weeks of me just being with them, talking with them, hanging out with them. You know, you have to remember, we moved out to this combat point to establish a new combat base. You know, we didn't have toilets. We didn't have a kitchen. We didn't have showers, you know, for, mm-hmm. you know, for a month. It's quite funny, because what you do is everybody has baby wipes, and that's how you basically clean down, you know, and everything else. So it's quite funny climbing into a, you know, an MRAT, big armored vehicle with a bunch of guys, you know, armed to the teeth and ready to kill. Everybody smelling like, you know, a fresh baby bottom. You know, it's kind of funny, but that's just the way it worked. But when I started going on helicopter missions and crashing through doors, and I was always at the point, they started to take notice. Interestingly enough, they also started to look me up on the internet. And they could do that because we had no, as I said, no toilets, no kitchen, no showers, no nothing. The first bit of kit that came in that I saw were these two Chinook helicopters flying in one morning and landing with these two big containers, and they set them down in the desert. You know what was in those? One was a bank of telephones, and one was a bank of computers with internet. They realized that to keep their boys happy, the first thing they had to do was let them be in touch with their families. And they did that every day. You would book time, you'd go in there, you'd have a half an hour on the internet, you'd have half an hour on the phone. You could go. Those were the first two bits of support gear that we didn't take in ourselves that came into that place. So when those things arrived a couple of weeks after we got there, people started looking me up on the internet, and you know, they found out that, you know, I was more like them than they realized. I was actually, my background in television news meant that I was a grunt just like them.
Right, exactly.
And once that happened, they started to warm up to me. It got to the point that I asked certain people for interviews, and I was sleeping in the command tent with the officers. And when it was time to do the interviews for the 2 weeks before I left, after 2.5 months, I moved into this old building that was ready to fall down. And I slept there with camel spiders and everything else. And Captain Thompson said, well, why are you going to do this? And I said, look, I can't. I'm going to be asking these guys questions. I can't be in the tent with you guys and them thinking that maybe I'm talking to you. And it got to be a point that I'd be in the middle of the night. Somebody would come into the room and kick my cot, you know, one of the soldiers. And he'd say, I want to be interviewed. And I'd say, okay. So I had the camera all set up and the lights set up. And it got to be that thing that the soldiers just would come by and say, can we talk? And it really was, you know, I call them confessional style interviews. And it really was like a confessional, you know. And, you know, some of the guys told me some really amazing stories and poured out their hearts and in really hard ways. I mean, some stuff I couldn't put on because when you're talking in a combat situation, it doesn't matter how you try to put it in context, it won't come out in context.
Right.
And if it was going to hurt them back home, I would stop the camera and say, look, I like what you're talking about and everything else, but, you know, you can't say it like that. You can't say, I'm going to go home and shoot my girlfriend because she's f***ing around on me. You know,
right.
You can't say that. You just can't say that, you know. So it was that kind of a thing that I would try and protect them. But when I knew I had broken through and I had their trust was one day walking into the HQ. And there was a board on the wall that had marking how many soldiers were on base, how many soldiers were doing refit, meaning they were leaving, going back to the bigger base. This was a combat outpost. They were going to the forward operating base where they could do things like eat Kentucky Fried Chicken, get a manicure, a massage, and everything, really, truly. Do a little shopping, you know, have some laughs, that sort of thing. How many translators were on the base, how many civilian employees, how many cooks, you know, that sort of thing. And they always had M1 cameraman. Right. And after weeks of working with these guys and going through doors and doing helicopter missions and having a few dicey operations, I walked into the HQ hut and I looked at the board and it was the same sort of thing. This many soldiers out on patrol, this many soldiers on base, this many soldiers on refit, cooks, civilian workers, Hollywood 6. And the thing was, I looked at that because the command, Captain Thompson, was known as Baker 6. Everybody has a code name. Well, on the radios, you don't use real names, you use codes. And I was always a cameraman on the board. And then I walked in this room one day and I saw Hollywood 6 on the board. I'd earned my own call sign. And that was the moment I realized I had their trust. But it was my farewell to all that.
Mm-hmm.
I left Iraq in 2003 and walked out on the war because I didn't want any part of it. And I went back to Iraq in 2008 to shoot this documentary. But I knew it was going to be different from everything I'd done before.
I'm a soldier of freedom in the army of the man. Oh, we are the chosen, we're the partisan. Well, the cause it is normal and the cause it is just. We are ready to pay with our lives if we are. Gonna ride across the river, deep and wide.
Tell you a story.
Okay.
When Angel City was published in the United States, I went to Washington, D.C. to get over the jet lag, stay with some friends for a couple days. And we were down on a bar along the river, Potomac River. It was a nice day. We were having brunch. And I kept going back to the bar to get fresh drinks. And there were these two guys sitting there. I could tell by their haircuts they were military. And they kept looking at me every time I go by and I say, you know, hi, guys. And, you know, I said, what's your outfit? You know, and they say, oh, it's that obvious. I said, oh, yeah. And, they said they were infantry and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, best of luck. And I went back and came back for another round of drinks. And one of the guys said, excuse me, sir, are you John Steele? And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, you're the guy that made Baker Boys. And I said, yes, I am. And I said, ah, damn, I told you he was. See, I told you he was. God, that was so great. That was so great. Wow, that was great. And I said, well, thank you very much. Where did you see it? You see it on a Discovery Channel or Netflix, or where did you see it? And he says, no, sir, they showed it to us in basic training.
Hmm. Wow.
And I went, wow. You know, and I said, why did they do that? And they said because they wanted us to know, you know, what kind of pressures we might be under. And I thought, you know, my father was military. He joined the military at, ran away from home and joined the military at just turning 17. Before he was hit 18, he was flying in bombers over the Pacific. He was in Korea, he was in Vietnam. And he's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And to hear that, just, like I said, I'm not a flag-waving American in any way, shape, or form. But I'm very critical of my country in many ways. But I was actually quite proud of that, mm-hmm. that when these guys said they showed it to us in basic training, I just thought, okay, well, that was a good enough reason to go there.
So how long after that was, did you actually get out? How long did it take to do the post-production and get it actually out?
Oh, I think it took about 9 months, months to a year.
Were you writing during that time, or did you finish with it all?
Yeah, I was working on The Watchers all through that. In fact, The Watchers had been written, and I was actually, when I was in Iraq, I was writing The Watchers.
The first time?
Parts of it.
The first time?
The first book of the trilogy, yeah. No. I had already done a couple of drafts of The Watchers. And when I was in Iraq, I was pretty much working on the final draft. And this is really a funny, interesting story. I'm glad you reminded me of it. When Baker Boys was finished, I was invited by the Foreign Correspondents Club. That's a great bar in Hong Kong. The Frontline Club in London, which is a club of special members of people who did the kind of work I did and journalists, and they always have programs there. And I was invited to come show a cut down version of the Baker Boys. And I said, okay. So I was living in Switzerland and Paris at the time, so it was quite easy. Just hopped the train over, went to London. And while I was there showing this film, in the audience was Doug Young, who was my publisher from War Junkie. And he watched this thing, and we sat around at the end having drinks and talking with a bunch of old hacks. And he says, I heard you wrote a novel. And I said, yeah, it's done. And he said, I want to read it. And I said, okay. So I went home and did one more draft on it. And he called my agent and said, I talked to John. He's got a novel. I want to read it. And she said, okay, great. And she's on to me. And I'm saying, I'm just going through it one more time. So agents being agents, she started to get very nervous that maybe there really wasn't a book because no one had ever seen it. But 2 weeks later, I sent it over to her and she sent it to Doug. And a couple of weeks after that, they came back and said, we're going to buy it. And then the Americans bought it, and a few other people bought it, and everybody wanted it to be a trilogy. So it's kind of funny how my life as a war cameraman and war junkie, my autobiography, and a book about angels trying to save all that's left of paradise all sort of came together on my last job as a cameraman working in conflict areas or war zones. So it's funny how that all happened, you know, and I haven't thought of that till you just said it. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of cool.
So you were writing this while you were in Iraq for the second time, not the first time, right? You weren't writing it at that point when you were in Jerusalem. This was back.
I was writing it when I was doing Baker Boys. Mm-hmm. I was writing the last draft while I was doing Baker Boys, which was kind of weird because guys would see me on my computer and say, you know, what you doing? And I say, I'm writing a book. And I go, what's it about? I said, angels hiding out in a cathedral. And they go, cool. You know.
You're listening to All Over the Road on OSCAT Radio, 89.5 FM KZCT in Vallejo, California. I'm Jeremy, and I'm speaking with John Steele about his Angelus trilogy, the final book of which was just published. And we've spent a long time leading up to this, so we're finally there. What do we expect out of the Angelus trilogy? What can you tell us about it? What's it about?
Everything that ever was, I think. It is on the surface, it is a story about the last of the good angels hiding out in Lausanne Cathedral, using Lausanne Cathedral and Switzerland as their base to protect all that's left of paradise. The biggest nightmare my publishers had was they all liked the book, obviously. They bought it and agreed to publish it. But it was, what do we call it? What kind of book is this? Is it fantasy? Well, no, it's not just fantasy. Is it science fiction? No, there's a lot of science in it. And let's face it, the difference between science fiction and science fact tends to be time. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, because a lot of things that we grew up thinking were science fiction are now fact. So it's not really science fiction.
You know what? I know exactly what you're talking about because I've had that same problem when I tell people that I'm going to have you on the show. And I tell them about the trilogy, and they say, "Well, what kind of a book is it?" And it's just exactly that. I jump right in and I say, "Well, it's fantasy. Well, historical fantasy. Okay, wait, no, there's some science fiction in it. You just have to read it."
That's probably the best plug I've had in a long time. Yeah, I tend to just call it, when people ask me, "Well, what do you call it?" I just call it mystical noir.
Okay.
My favorite writer in the English language is Raymond Chandler, who was a detective fiction writer, but he was writing literature disguised as detective fiction. I'm a big fan of James Ellroy, his sort of hard hitting, punchy. Machine gun paced dialogue, that sort of thing. So noir has a big effect on me, and I was a great fan of noir films, and Japanese detective noir films too that are quite fascinating. But it's also includes all this other stuff: religion, science, fantasy, philosophy, legends, myths. So I just crammed that all together and called it mystical noir.
I think my favorite, just really brief, to the point description of the book comes from Declan Burke, who said, "It's Paradise Lost, written by Raymond Chandler in a fevered dream." Yeah, that pretty much sums up what I've read.
Yeah, Declan, who I don't know. I know him professionally because he's written some nice things about all the books of the trilogy, and he writes about books for the Irish Times. He's also a great mystery writer, Declan Burke, and you just look up his stuff and his stories, and we are both fans of Raymond Chandler. We know that because we've written each other back and forth, and we know we're both fans of Raymond Chandler, but to be honest, he's far better at writing Raymond Chandler than I am. But he's a good lad, and he's a very good lad, and he's always been encouraging along the way with a trilogy.
I was trying to figure out how to approach this without giving away too much for people who haven't read it already. And you know what? I'm going to just put it on you, because I think you've probably done this enough that you have an idea how not to put in too many spoilers in it. But let's start out by talking about the Watchers, which is set in and around Lausanne, where you live for the most part. Tell us more about that and where else we go besides Lausanne. Just walk us through the trilogy in, terms that won't give away too much.
Well, the first book, The Watchers, basically takes place all in Lausanne. There is a side trip to Montreux, down the east end of the lake from Lausanne. There is some information that comes out of Geneva on the west end of the lake, and Paris. But generally the book takes place in Lausanne and all centered around Lausanne Cathedral, which takes on this mystical identity because of the fellow that works there through the night and calls the hour. He lives up in the belfry, Leguet de Lausanne. The story is built around him and who he is. He thinks the cathedral is a hiding place for lost angels. And as you start to go into the book very slowly, you realize he's right. He's not mad. And it's like figuring out, okay, who are the angels? Because everybody you come across is either a drunk, a druggie, a killer, somebody who appears to be a corrupt cop, and a washed-up detective who has no idea of who he is. So you throw all these things together, and it just sort of eats up the storyline of book one. Is one of these geographical points in the world that are incredibly important to our history as human beings, and probably something more ancient. Almost as if, having lived in Jerusalem for 5 years, the idea that this is the holy city, Jerusalem, it really does affect you that way. You really do feel that there is something ancient about it, and you study the history of Jerusalem, and it's older than, you know, when the Jewish people, you know, conquered it as it was in the Bible. So, like Jerusalem, Lausanne in The Watchers develops as almost just as important a place, something mystical, something spiritual, something connected to the unknown ancient history of mankind and where they came from and why they're here, and the nature of men's souls is revealed in this book, and that sort of makes Lausanne this very interesting place.
Ultimately, by the time we get to The Way of Sorrows, the last book in the trilogy, we end up in Jerusalem. And in the interim, in the middle of it, in Angel City, we have another major location. Why don't you tell us about Angel City?
Yeah, Angel City sort of spreads out from Lausanne as we enter deeper into the world of angels who are based in Lausanne and Switzerland. And we start to see that there is more of a network than we actually understood in The Watchers around the world. And the first place we go to is Paris. And activities that happen there in Paris, especially under Paris in the catacombs, lead us to a place called Montségur, which is in the southeast of France, on the border of the Pyrenees, very close to Spain, just Spain is on the other side of the mountains. Montségur is a region of Occitania, as it was called before it was incorporated into France. It was fiercely independent from the King of France until about the 11th, 12th century. It was that's when the king made his big push south. And in Monsegur, we have a fortress that is known as the Cathar Castle. There are really no such things as Cathar castles. It's where the Cathars took refuge when the French king teamed up with the Pope in Rome to wipe out the Cathars. And the French crusaders came down into Occitania to basically get rid of the heresy of the Cathars, and they began to wipe them out all over the region of France. Monsegur itself, the fortress where the 200 Cathars withdrew for their last stand, sits atop a geographical formation known as a Pluton. It's basically what's left of a volcano. All the mountainside falls apart, and it's just the center core that's standing there. Something like Devil's Tower in Wyoming that everybody knows from E.T.? Yeah.
Close Encounters.
Close Encounters, yeah. It was one of those space movies. Mm-hmm. Yep. Close Encounters, yeah. It's very much like that. And on top of the Pluton in Monsegur, there was just enough room for this fortress where 200 Cathars, who were pacifists and vegetarians and very spiritual in a unique way, were defended by 200 lords and fighters of Occitania. And they held off the French crusaders, an army of 10,000 soldiers for 9 months before they were finally, the siege was broken. They surrendered. The French crusaders gave them a choice, abandon Catharism or die. And they said, okay, we'll die. So the next day they were marched down from the Pluton and taken to this open field that is now called the Field of the Burned. And they were rounded up into this these walls of wood and straw. And they were set alight. And it was a few decades after that that the last of the Cathars was finally wiped out. But Monsegur is looked at as the last stand of the Cathars, generally.
So that's the broad strokes canvas that the Angelus trilogy is painted on. And we've heard some of the characters. We heard Mark Rochat, who inhabits the Lausanne Cathedral. And we've heard Harper, who... Wait, how would you describe Harper? How do you describe him when people ask you?
This is the hard part about talking about a book that people haven't read. You know, it's when we meet him in The Watchers, he is somebody without a history. All he knows is he works for something called Guardian Services Limited, and he's been given a job doing security for the International Olympic Committee, which is in Lausanne. And he gets down here and slowly finds out that he's actually being manipulated by forces that tell him what to do, and he just slowly discovers he has no choice but to do whatever he's told. And he keeps fighting this, and he has no memory of a life, but he starts having flashes of things coming back to him. That's where we meet him in the first book. I'll just add the one thing about Monsegur with Angel City is there's a lot of action in Paris, Monsegur, but it all goes back to the cathedral again, where it sort of leaves there. And at the same time, there's another thing happening in another part of the world, in Portland, Oregon. And Angel City just ends on this cliffhanger of it's almost like someone takes your breath away, which gets us going into the third book. Cliffhangers are funny. Obviously, Angel City was the middle book, and it's important to say that before I started writing these books, I knew the ending of the trilogy. I knew the ending of the third book before I started writing the first book. And that meant we were basically looking at one story of about 500,000 words. So the pacing and flow of the story is, you know, The Watchers starts very slow, which is just the way I wanted it. I wanted people to, like, get to know the place, feel like they're there, get to know the characters, not know too much about them, and a little bit, little bit, little bit, and then bam. You know, the story just kind of blows up in your face and you go, oh my God, what is this? Angel City comes in with an attack in Paris, with what looks like a terrorist attack in Paris, and it's just all guns blazing, you know, from chapter one. Mm-hmm. And Angel City pretty much runs along like that, and you start to get this idea that you're having this almost a road movie feel to it, which made it very easy to bring in this character called Crinkle, who is a rock and roll roadie, with his magic bus that he sort of picks up Harper, and like any good roadie does, you know, Harper is the main act, and a roadie is the guy that makes sure he stays in one piece and gets him on stage at the right time, uh-huh. You know. So Angel City sort of roars along and hits this cliffhanger at the end of the book, and I always knew it was going to be like that. And I said, well, I'm, you know, some people are going to hate me for this, but this is just the way it's got to be. It's just absolutely the way it's got to be. And I wanted it to feel like one of those moments emotionally that go back to my life as being a cameraman in dodgy places, where, you know, there have been literally moments where I did not know if I was going to take another breath. Mm-hmm. I would literally just think, oh God, this is it. You know, I'm dead. You know, it's over, it's done. And I wanted Angel City to end exactly how I felt from my life as a cameraman. And then we move into book three, The Way of Sorrows.
It does end like that, too. It's like all of a sudden it stops. Luckily, there is not the need for that because the entire trilogy is now written. Therefore, you can just pick up the third book and go right into it.
That's actually quite interesting because, you know, there were people who would say to me that another character, Catherine Taylor, that we meet in the first book, The Watchers, who is a high-class call girl working for something called the 200 Club in Europe, who's on the run from the IRS, and she's being taken care of by these very, very rich people and living quite the life until she finds out her life is a bit of a nightmare. But there were people who read the first book, and you would say, well, she's kind of a weak character. She doesn't, you know, she's just, you know, she's kind of cliched a bit. And I'd say, okay, you know. And as I said before, I already knew where the story was going, mm-hmm. all the way to the end of the third book. I knew it was going to happen to each of these characters, and I knew how they were going to develop. And, you know, all these, you know, pages and pages and pages and chapters later, you know, people are, you know, they go, wow, Catherine! You know, uh-huh. It's one thing I did not want to do in writing these stories was I didn't want this to be like, you know, a James Bond movie that, you know, you see a James Bond movie, and I love the new series of James Bond movies. I really love them. I think they're very edgy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's basically the same story, you know. And, well, right. You know, it's always going to end, you know, pretty much the same way. The later movies have gotten better at developing a thread through the stories, which is what I wanted to do through the three books. I wanted it to be one story that was going to move slowly in some places, very fast in some places, be funny in some places. You know, it's a long journey we're taking in these three stories. There is, I mean, The Watchers takes place over, I think, 10 days, 12 days. Then there's an 18-month gap before Angel City comes up in the timing of the stories, but Angel City takes place in about a week. And The Way of Sorrows takes place in a matter of a few days. So it's always, along with developing the rhythm of the story through three books, there's been, you know, the timing and compressing the story into, like, building it into, you know, tensions, trying to get tensions in the right moment, like the cliffhanger at the end of Angel City, or, you know, within each book, you know, the rhythm of action and dialogue and reflection, trying to get all those things right. You know, I'm sure I didn't do it, you know, as well as I could in some areas. And but, you know, that's what I really tried to do. And happily, a lot of people, you know, pick up on that and sort of get the idea that they've enjoyed taking this trip.
I'm one of those. You know,
glad to hear it.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have any of the complaints that you just said. I thought the characters developed perfectly. I mean, I didn't have an issue with that at all. I thought by the end of The Watchers, Catherine Taylor was exactly where she needed to be.
And that's the idea. The funny thing is, now that the trilogy is finished, all three books are out there, it's almost a completely different animal. I mean, The Watchers was The Watchers, the introductory book. The Angel City sort of built on that and everything else, but it was always incomplete. It was always like watching halfway through a movie and then, you know, somebody knocks on your door and, you know, your bathtub is leaking downstairs or something and, you know, you get back to the real world and it's done, you know. But it's very interesting because with the Way of Sorrows done and completed and the trilogy finished, you do see it now as one story, and readers are really connecting to that, and I get messages and letters from people that, you know, they get it. They you know, they can see it as one thing. It's like seeing the completed film now. And I think it's always been an incomplete work. It's been an ongoing book, because it is just one book. It's been an ongoing book for 5 to 6 years. It's never been finished until now. My own thinking about it and my own emotional relationship to it is completely different now than it was while I was working through it, mainly in the fact that it's done. It's finished.
Locomotora on All Over the Road. Their music figured so strongly into the writing of the Angelus trilogy that Steele wrote the band into the book. That's going to wrap up our autobiography of author John Steele. I really can't express enough thanks to John for all of the time that he took out to do these interviews. 6 hours, I think, of interview time, including one marathon 3-hour session where we just got on a roll and never stopped. So that was 3 hours without a net. No notes, no reference. So if there are some dates that get a little fuzzy in it, they're right there in War Junkie with the research dates. Thanks also to Blue Rider Press and Penguin Press for publishing John's books. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to go on this journey. And thanks to you for taking it with us. I'm Jeremy McCaleb. It's All Over the Road. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I enjoyed doing it. And thanks, JD.